11th of May.
It's the 11th of May, 2015, and it's just after 3:15 in the afternoon. This is John Batty with Irini Dzortoglou and Freddie Perry, and we're actually sitting in Freddie's living room at his house in the village of Cartmel. Freddie, thanks very much indeed, firstly, for agreeing to let us talk to you and get some of your memories about the village, and in particular the Priory, where I know you've been a very important player in the Priory over the past few years or so. But can we start firstly by you telling us your full name and your date of birth?
Well, my full name actually is Bertram Edward Perry, but I never liked my given name as a child, and when I was at school, Fred Perry was the champion tennis player, so I got called Fred, and it's stuck ever since. I was born on the 17th of December 1922 in Broccoli, South East London.
So is it okay if I call you Freddie for this?
Oh yes, that's what everybody calls me Freddie.
Everybody calls you Freddie, okay. Yeah. So Freddie, maybe the first thing to ask is just a little bit about your family background. Have you got brothers and sisters, children, grandchildren?
I used to have a sister, but she's died. I used to have a wife and she's died, unfortunately. I've got one daughter who lives down in near Cambridge, near Fenstanton.
Does she have any children of her own?
Yes, she has two children. So my grandchildren is one grandson and one granddaughter who lives in America.
And have they got any children?
No. The ones in America have adopted a Chinese girl. They've just adopted her little two-year-old.
So that's, in a way, that's your great-grandchild.
Yes, that's right.
And Freddie, when did you first, what was your first connection with Cartmel? How did you first come either to visit the village or, can you give us a little bit about how you actually came to know about Cartmel and finally to move here?
Yes, my wife's parents were retired from Manchester and lived in Grange, and my wife Joyce and I used to come up most weekends to Grange to help them with the garden and things like that. And of course we came into Cartmel from time to time. Now one time when we came in, this house where we are now was originally a barn, a stone-built barn, and we noticed that it was being converted into a couple of houses. And we thought at the time that somebody had bought it and was converting it themselves. But later on, when we came again, we found a notice saying for sale to residences.
And Freddie, excuse me, when would this have been?
This was towards the end of 1973.
So you saw the for sale sign?
Yes. And we were wanting to move ourselves from Manchester, and my wife's parents, my stepfather had died, and my wife's mother, who was widowed, wanted to come and live with us. And so we thought, if we bought these two houses, we bought this one, and my wife's mother bought the other one. She was living under the same roof, but with separate front doors, which suited us very well. That's how we came to be here.
So you moved here in 1973?
Right at the end, yes. It was Christmas 1973.
And was your daughter alive at that time?
Oh yes, she was alive. She lived down near Cambridge.
Even then, in 1973?
Yes.
What did you do for a job, Freddie?
I worked for ICI. I was a metallurgist, but I worked for ICI, which was staffed mainly by chemists, but I was sort of advising on the materials of construction for the plant, which involved some rather nasty mixtures of acids and things, so it needed some quite careful selection of materials.
Was that a local ICI?
That was in Fleetwood.
And were you travelling down to Fleetwood from Cartmel?
Yes, the first 6 years I was here, I travelled down every day, there and back, 50 miles there and 50 miles back. So there wasn't really very much time to do anything else here, except at weekends when I was quite busy doing odd jobs.
How did you get to Fleetwood every day?
I drove down in car.
And in those days, was the M6 there?
It was towards the end, but only towards the end of the time I was travelling.
How long would it have taken you to get there?
It was about an hour and a quarter.
So a lot of your time, well, a lot of your day was spent travelling there and back.
It was, yes. I found in the end that well, most of my time was spent travelling and working, and I thought I needed a bit more spare time, so I took early retirement in the end. I retired in 1980.
Now, you mentioned that the house was a barn. At what point was it converted from a barn into a private residence?
Just before we moved in. We moved in when it was completed. So it was September to... Well, the middle of 73 to the end of 73.
And I think you do know a bit of the history, not just of this property, but also the adjoining properties, don't you?
Yes. St Mary's Lodge, which is the big house attached to the barn, was originally the home farm. And this was the stone barn attached to it. I understand that it was built about 300 years ago, and we were told that it was used quite often by the villagers. This was before the village hall was built, so the villagers used this barn as a sort of venue for entertainment. And we were told that one of the music hall dames of the time, I forget who it was, I think it was Ellen Terry or somebody like that, actually came and performed here for the villagers. I don't know how true that is, but that's what we were told.
Alan Terry, did you say? Ellen Terry.
Yeah.
Terry.
Yeah, she was a famous music hall dame.
Music hall artiste, yeah.
And Freddie, when you were working in Fleetwood 5 days a week, your wife was here though, was she?
Yes, she was, yes.
And how did she spend her time?
Well, she was mainly looking after her mother, who was needed quite a lot of attention. And of course, we had two houses which... had to be sort of brought into living condition, all the furniture moved in and everything got ship-shape. So she was quite busy.
And what do you remember of the village at the time when you first arrived here?
Well, I was a bit anxious that we would be accepted in the village, because I know that in some small villages... people who move in are treated as foreigners, more or less for the whole of their lives. But we found when we came here that people accepted us quite happily, and we were very, very content with that.
What facilities were there in the village at the time in terms of shops and the like?
Well, there were mainly the essentials were here. You know, there was a the two shops which sold food and a few medicines and things like that. There were three pubs.
And which three were they, Freddie? Because we've got four today.
Yes, that's right. There were four pubs, that's right. You're correct, yeah. They were all here at the time, yes. They haven't changed since we've been here.
And you became... very closely involved with the Priory, I understand.
Yes. We used to go on a Sunday, of course, even when I was working, but when I was retired, I was able to do a bit more. And I think it was in 1987 I became church warden.
What were the duties of the church warden in those days?
Well, it was mainly to sort of keep order on a Sunday. But during the time I was church warden, the vicar left the parish, and of course that means that there are more duties attached to the that position of church warden, you'd be involved in finding another vicar and also looking after some of the things that the vicar would do in the ordinary way. So it was quite busy.
On a normal Sunday, though, what would your duties have been? Could you just sort of take us through a typical Sunday?
Yes, well, you'd get there about 3/4 of an hour before the service was due to start. One of the things you had to do was fetch the churchwarden's staves, which were kept up in the vestry, and put those in the churchwarden's pews. There were 3 churchwardens, by the way. I was only one of the 3. And then you had to see that there were books, hymn books and prayer books put out for the congregation. Oversee the sidesmen who were welcoming the people coming in, and if any strangers came, you would conduct them to their seats. And then after the service, of course, you'd have to make sure that everything was tidied up and the church was in order. And then had to on special occasions, of course, supposing the bishop came for a service, you'd have to escort the bishop with your staves of office, which is quite an occasion.
Did you handle money? Were there collections in those days?
Yes, that's right. There were, yes. Yes. The 2 of the sidesmen would count the collection in the vestry after the service. And then the treasurer would make sure it was put in the safe.
How many services would there be on a normal Sunday, Freddie?
There were 3 services. An early communion service at about 8 o'clock, and then at 11:15 there was a service of either Matins or Eucharist, and then at 3:30 in the winter or 6:30 in the summer there'd be a sung evensong.
And you had to be present at all 3 of those?
Normally, yes, we'd be present at all 3. Sometimes I missed out on the early morning service because you don't really need more than 1 sidesman for that. But for the main service of the day, which was the morning 10:45 service, all 3 church and wardens would normally be there.
Did you need to help at funerals, weddings, christenings?
Yes, anything like that, christenings. In fact, before I became a church warden, I was involved with a christening. Not a christening.
Baptism?
No. The bishop lays on hands.
A confirmation.
Confirmation, that's right. Yeah, a confirmation service. Because one of the church wardens at the time couldn't make it, and I was asked if I could stand in for her, which I did, and apparently it was quite successful. So I was asked after that to be a church warden when she retired.
Freddie, how big was the congregation in those days?
It was about 125, 130, up to, of course, twice in the year, that's the Easter and Christmas midnight mass service, the church was absolutely full. People, in fact, we had to bring chairs from the town choir to put at the back of the nave to seat all the extra people. The church was really full. It would hold about 500 people.
So 125 would be a typical congregation,
yes,
which would be about 1/4 of the capacity of,
yeah,
the priory.
That's right.
And how have you seen the congregation change over the years that you've been involved?
It's remained more or less the same, really. People, I mean, there are only 600 people in the village, and obviously not all of those come to church every Sunday, but we get a fair number, but quite a few people come in either Grange or from other surrounding villages. So we get a reasonable congregation every Sunday.
How many vicars have you seen pass through in your years?
One, two, three, four. This is the fourth one now.
Can you tell us the names?
Yes. When I first joined, it was Derek Stiff. And then there was Chris Atkinson. And then there was... Father Robert Bailey, and at the moment it's
Nick Devonish.
Sorry, my memory for names is terrible.
Did you have a favourite amongst them?
I liked Derek Stiff and Robert Bailey, the best, I think, of the vicars we had. They were both very, very friendly. Chris Atkinson, he was efficient as a vicar, but he didn't sort of strike one as being that friendly. And Nick Devonish is also okay, but not being involved too much with the running of the church now, I don't have as much to do with him.
Freddie, we've just seen the new roof go on the church recently, but what other changes to the building itself, the fabric of the building itself, can you tell us about?
Well, at one time we did want to have a new heating system put in, and we thought the system we would like would be a system which required a big sort of hot air blower, which would have been housed in an addition to the church on the north side, which is the side which is not usually too obvious. But unfortunately, we weren't able to do that. We couldn't get permission to do the building work, so that fell through. That's been the only sort of major change to the fabric of the church. But during the time I was church warden, it came up for the time of the 800th anniversary of the priory. It was founded round about 1188, so in 1988, when I was church warden, it was going to be the centenary, the 800th centenary. And we decided that what we would like to do would be to put in a new bell frame and a new set of bells, because the old bell frame was getting very weak and it made ringing the bells rather difficult. So we decided to do that, and I was in charge of the group of chaps who were doing the actual work. We had a professional bell hanger come in to supervise us and do the technical things, and we did the hard work. And it was quite hard work too. We had to haul up the steelwork for the new frame. We took out the old oak frame. Part of that is still in the lower ringing chamber, and we took down the bells. We decided that two of the bells were okay. They were the two trebles, which were of fairly recent origin. The two biggest bells were about 1735. They were quite old, and the two middle ones were also quite old. And we decided that we had to keep the two big ones anyway. They couldn't be destroyed, so we had to keep those. But we decided to keep all four eventually. So we had four new bells cast, and the new bell frame, which was a mixture of cast iron and steel, was designed to accommodate both the four old bells and the four new bells and the two existing trebles. So we have 10 bells actually, which means that we have an old peal of 6 bells and a new peal of 6 bells, so that it is possible, particularly on the new year, to ring out the old year with the old peal and ring in the new year with the new peal.
And do the old and new bells have different sounds? Can you tell the difference?
The old bells tend to be slightly out of tune. I mean, the new bells obviously were all tuned to the two trebles to be an absolutely precise peal. But the old bells, I must admit, are slightly out of tune, but they still sound very well.
And can they not be tuned? I don't know anything about bells, so I'm...
It means machining part of them off, which is not easy with old bells, because they tend to go out of shape. And, of course, also they tend to wear, particularly where the clapper strikes the bell, you get a low area, and that makes machining difficult. It is possible to tune them, but it's very, very difficult.
Where were the new bells cast?
They're actually cast in Holland. We got a very good quotation from a firm of bell casters in Holland, and so we had them made there.
And do you have any idea of how much they would have cost?
Not offhand, no. I've got the figure somewhere, but I've forgotten what the cost was.
So tell us a bit more about the bells. How many bell, what do we call them?
Ringers.
Bell ringers. How many bell ringers do we have?
There are six bell ringers and a head bell ringer who gives the orders to change. They change from time to time, you know, one bell in place of another in different order. So the tower captain, who's the head ringer, usually gives the orders.
And I think we hear sometimes them practising during the week.
Yes, they practise usually on a Wednesday evening or something like that. And we also get teams of bell ringers from other churches across the country who visit and like to ring different sets of bells.
And when are the bells actually rung? Is there a rota, certain dates during the week or times of the day when they're rung?
They're rung for every Sunday for the main service. That's the main bell ringing during the week. Of course, if there are weddings, they also can be rung. In fact, most weddings do have the bells. One of the extras we provide for weddings.
So they are rung for the service. Are they rung before the service to let people know?
Half an hour before the service, yes.
And just once? Just that once? Not during the service or at the end?
Oh, no, not during the service. Except communion services, the tenor bell, which is the biggest bell, is rung 3 times to let the village know that the communion is being served.
Just in case they would only pop in for the communion and rush home again.
I don't think that happens very often, but just to let the village know that it is happening.
Have you tried yourself, Freddy, to ring the bells?
I was asked if I would like to become a bell ringer, but I didn't particularly want to do it.
What are the qualities that are required? Is it physical strength and a sense of
Some quite frail young ladies are bell ringers. It doesn't require a great deal of strength, but it does require a sense of timing. Obviously, you know, you have to make sure that you're absolutely in time with the other bell ringers. And if you get a new ringer, you can usually tell that the peal doesn't sound quite right.
But each bell only has one note, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yes, and the thing is, you toll the bell by swinging it down and then swinging it up again. And the thing about a peal of bells is that a bell is kept on the up position until it's required to be rung again. That means that you can change the order of the notes, because you have a chance to keep it there a bit longer and let another bell ring his bell in the space provided.
And will the Priory train new bell ringers? As you mentioned, you were asked if you wanted to become a bell ringer. Would the Priory give you training? Would the people there...
Yes, there is a need for new bell ringers occasionally, and they seem to be able to keep up the number of bell ringers at the required number. Okay.
Was there ever any cause for the bells to ring outside normal church life? I don't know if in this country the bells ring in extraordinary circumstances.
Well, of course, during the war, church bells weren't allowed to be rung, except to warn of an invasion, which didn't happen. But at the end of the war, of course, on VE Day, which we've just had the 70th anniversary of, all the church bells were rung. It was a great celebration.
Did they ring them on, for example, a royal wedding or a special national celebration?
If it's a national celebration, yes, they can be rung, but it doesn't happen very often.
Freddie, what other kind of special events have taken place at the Priory over the years?
Well, we have, as I say, on occasion, the bishop visits the church.
The BBC choir came and
did
the recording?
We have concerts, yes.
Concerts.
We used to have them every Saturday evening during the summer, but more recently... They've become less frequent. We have about twice a month a concert in the Priory in the evening, Saturday evening.
Is that the Choral Society?
No, it's different. The Choral Society do give a concert, usually just before Christmas, but it's normally either instrumentalists, solos, or choirs of different kinds who visit. Yeah.
And you said, Freddie, about the 800 years celebrations from the date the Priory was first set.
Yeah.
How did you mark that year? How was it marked?
Well, there was a bit of a difficulty at first because, as I say, the date normally associated with the formation of the Priory was 1188, but there was a medieval historian in the village, Dr. John Dickinson, who was insistent that they couldn't possibly have started the Priory as early as that. It must have been 1189 or even later than that. So we had a big argument for quite a long time, and we finally decided to avoid any friction to have the celebration over 2 years, 1988 and 1989, to make sure we covered it. So the celebration went on for longer than we originally intended. But
did you celebrate? How?
Oh, well, there were various things going on during the year, special concerts, and we had a sort of play in the village square, a mystery play, on the original medieval type things, which was rather fun.
Everybody took part?
Yes, yes, yes. The villagers have always been very supportive of the church. I mean, even those that don't come to the church, it's a part of their heritage, and everybody, you know, supports the prior if any support is needed. We found that very soon after we came here.
Yeah. Fred, in the time that you've lived in the village, and obviously as a warden as well, have you noticed general differences in the congregation, in the behavior, in the dress manner, in the numbers? You said that the numbers have remained more or less the same.
The age profile, perhaps?
Yes, yeah. The age profile. Have
we
you noticed
used to
differences?
Have more youngsters in the church, and in fact, recently they've tried to attract more youngsters by having, you know, children's services from time to time. And of course, when I first came here, there were quite a few boys in the choir, but over the years they have disappeared, and now there are no youngsters in the choir at all. Well, very occasionally there's a young girl, but not very often. It's mainly just men.
Why do
and
you
women.
Think that is?
I don't know. I think there just seemed to have been a falling off in general support of churches in over the country, I think. And I think the children are more given their head nowadays. You know, when I was a child, if your parents went to church, you went with them, and, you know, it was a dumb thing. But nowadays, if the children don't want to go, they don't go, and that's it. But there has been a change, I think, in the style of dress too. More or less mirroring the general trend towards more casual dress. When I first started going to church, every lady went to church with a hat. You know, you couldn't find a lady without a hat in church. Nowadays, most of the ladies don't wear hats at all. Some of the older ones do, but they're mostly just. And there is a general tendency to the dress to be more casual. Of course, being a place where people come for holidays, you must expect some of the holidaymakers to be casually dressed anyway. That's not surprising. But the general the general thing is that the dress is more casual.
I haven't noticed. Are there any restrictions, any notes saying you cannot enter in shorts, or is there a restriction on people?
No, I don't think. I think people are left to the, you know, use their own common sense about what would be, you know, appropriate. I don't think there's any direct sort of instructions about it.
And Fred, earlier you said something that I found intriguing, that when once the, maybe it was regularly happening, I don't know, but if a vicar left, then it fell on the wardens to find the new vicar? Is that right?
Well, yes. In the old days, there was a patron, which is Lord Cavendish, and he and the three church wardens together would find the new vicar. Yeah, they'd announce it in the church press and get applicants to come and interview them, things like that. There was a interregnum while I was a church warden, and it was quite interesting, really, because we found we had a first series of applicants, and we found one who we thought would be very suitable. Actually, He had obviously had relations in the district in the past. What was his name? Switch it off.
It doesn't
matter. It was he was called Kerwin Rawlinson. Now both Kerwin and Rawlinson are names of ancient families in the area. So obviously he had, you know, historical connections, and he was a very nice man anyway. So we were only too pleased to offer him the job. Unfortunately, just a week before he was due to start, he gave back word because his wife, who I think they lived in Wiltshire, his wife didn't want to leave all her friends down there. So we had to start the whole procedure over again and get another batch of applicants. Eventually we did find a vicar, but it made it a long, very long interregnum.
But these days, wouldn't it be the job of Church of England to appoint the vicar?
The system is slightly different now. The patron and church wardens are not the only people involved. The archdeacon and a whole lot of other people are also involved, and I don't really know what the system is now. It's certainly much different from what it was when I was church warden.
Freddie, before we finish, just a few more general questions. And of course, you've already been kind enough to share with us your portfolio of postcards that you've got of the village. When did you start collecting those postcards, and where did you find them, and did you have a particular theme?
Well, I've more or less been collecting them from when I started, when I first came here. But I finished collecting about 7 or 8 years ago. But mainly, they came from the antiques fairs in the village hall. There's a postcard dealer who comes there every time, and I used to go through his stock, you know, and pick up any new ones he'd got. So he was my main source of supply.
You were his best customer.
Sorry?
You were his best customer.
Well, one of his best customers, yes.
Do you have any other old records of the village, or we're always interested to see paintings or documents. You know, Ewan's got a lot of documents.
Well, I have quite a few pictures of, you know, watercolours of the village, which were we used to get those from. There was a dealer in Cartmel who used to have paintings available for sale, and we used to buy one or two from him.
Is this somebody who had a shop in Cartmel?
It was the what is now there used to be the forge, the blacksmith forge.
Lenclum, the restaurant.
Lenclum, yes, yeah, as it is now, yeah. That used to be owned by a chap who was an art dealer.
And did he have was it a gallery? Did it?
Yes, he had a gallery there, yes. It was the place that used to be the post office, which is alongside Lenclum.
Oh, yes, on Cavendish Street.
On Cavendish Street, yes, right. Yes.
Do you remember his name, by any chance, Freddie? I know you said you're bad with names. It's not a fair question.
No, I can't remember.
Just in case.
No, sorry.
Okay. And what other changes in the village have you seen over time?
Well, compared with big cities, I mean, it's surprisingly constant. You know, it doesn't change all that much. One of the things that I remember from when we first came was there was a doctor's surgery in Cavendish Street, practically opposite the Cavendish Arms. There was a Dr. Atkinson, who was a lovely doctor, and we used to go in to see him, and he would chat, you know, and you'd talk about all sorts of things. In fact, quite a few people commented that quite often they went to leave and remembered they hadn't mentioned what was wrong with them. He was such a friendly individual.
Did he actually live in the...
He lived up at Hill Mill. He had a receptionist, Monica Wright, who was also very, very well known in the village. She was also a bell ringer, actually. She was, in fact, at one time, the tower captain. Monica was a lovely, lovely girl. When we were doing the bells and bell frame, Monica Wright used to come up the tower three times a day with a tray with cups of coffee and biscuits. And there's 83 steps up that tower, of a spiral staircase, and I must admit I was amazed that she did that all the time, you know, while we were working. It was a real joy to see her.
Freddie, did the doctor's surgery close when the health centre, the clinic on Hags Lane, opened?
Yes, well, Dr. Atkinson, when he retired, actually he was quite... busy trying to make sure that another doctor was appointed, because there was quite a chance that there wouldn't be a doctor's surgery in Cartmel at all. But Doc Atkinson actually made sure that we had a new doctor and a new surgery.
And in those days, was it just the residents of the village who were entitled to go to the doctor, or could anybody go? If a visitor to the village wasn't well,
anybody could go. Yes. It was, of course, the NHS was in force at that time. It was more or less the same system as we have today.
And if the doctor gave you a prescription, where would you go to get the medicine or the?
Well, I think. I don't quite remember what was the system with Dr. Atkinson. Nowadays, of course, you just get the prescription served at the surgery. I can't remember whether that was the case with Dr. Atkinson. I don't think it was, actually. We would probably get a prescription form and have to go down to a chemist in Grange.
Anything else, or I think we've probably covered it, so...
No. One or two of the people who were here when we first came, and one or two of them were very helpful to Joyce. There was a chap called... Tim Hunt. He was a doctor. A retired doctor. Actually, his daughter Tiffany still lives in Barngarth, but Tim Hunt was a lovely man. He was very friendly, and you could sort of talk to him about anything. And there was another. Oh, Tom Weir. Yes, Tom Weir was another very chap who was he was Scot. And he was very, very useful for Joyce because she didn't know anybody, and she was, a bit at sea. And Tom pointed out everybody. He knew everybody in the village, and he knew he pointed out to Joyce and sort of looked after her when she first came here. He was quite a character, actually. I remember there was a lady who lived in the village. I can't remember her name, but she had rather an outstanding posterior, and Tom Weir saw him going past one, saw this lady go past one time, and said to Joyce, "Ah, there's Mrs. So and So, waggling her bogey."
Freddie, I think to end it there before you tell us things that you shouldn't tell us.
I think that would be a good idea, yes.
Thank you very much indeed. That was absolutely fascinating. We're very grateful to you. Right. And we will get everything written out and give you a copy of the recording
right.
as soon as we can get it finished. Thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
This should be okay now because it's not flashing anymore. So
we're going to try again. So this is John sitting on Freddy's right.
This is me sitting on Freddy's left.
And this is me sitting right where Freddy's sitting.